Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon, a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I am your host, Shane Bacon, and we've got a good one this week. I feel like I say that every week. You know what I need to start doing? If they're mediocre, I'm going to say that. We got an okay one this week. We got a kind of a crappy one this week, but this one is good. Justin Suh on. Justin is a guy I met when he was in college at USC, and he was the number one ranked amateur in the world, and he is a really nice kid, bright young kid with a ton of talent, and he turned professional and was a part of kind of a Miami Heatian type of press conference at the Travelers with Matthew Wolf and Victor Hovland and Colin Morikawa, kind of an introduction to the world for these star-studded amateur players that were all going to turn professional. And Justin has battled a little bit of injury and has had to go through, you know, a different process than some of those other guys have had to go through as he has made his way in these professional ranks just, you know, a year and a half or so into it. And the results have started to come, and it's been great to see. I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. As I mentioned, he's a great kid. And at the end, I make him super uncomfortable with the quiz that I throw his way. So you'll have to wait for that at the end. Hope you're well. Hope you're getting a chance to play a little bit of golf. I know in a lot of parts of the country, golf is going away, and that's a bummer. I just was up at Erin Hills last week. Little chilly in Wisconsin if you go in late September, early October, but you know we packed accordingly and had the beanies and the gloves and you know sweaters and it was vest weather. You just got to have a vest on no matter what the temperature is if it's cold, especially if you live in a hot weather place like I do in Arizona. But hadn't been up to Erin Hills since basically I drove away from our rental home back in 2017. You know, after the U.S. Open, I did the interviews that year for Fox and for the U.S. Open Championship. And yeah, it was great to go back and see it. I mean, it's always crazy when you see a U.S. Open golf course before the U.S. Open. So, you know, when we'd be up there for media day, I went up there in 2016 with my dad to play Erin Hills and just get a feel for that golf course late in that season. And you go to Erin Hills and you see the golf course and it's spectacular. And then you get there for U.S. Open week and it almost doesn't even look like the same place with all the tents and the grandstands and just everything. So it was nice to get back to what Erin Hills originally and kind of usually looks like. And it was awesome. It was championship worthy. It beat us up one day with like 30 mile per hour winds. My Gen app added strokes. I'd never seen that before. I think it's called PCC, where it's basically the conditions you play in. It added three strokes to our score that day, or I guess subtracted those from our score, considering the winds were up so high. And yeah, man, that is a golf course that reminds you how good the pros are, because we definitely weren't shooting, you know, 63 like Justin Thomas. And there are places around that golf course where you see what the pros did and what you do. And it's humbling. It's a reminder. But big thanks to Erin Hills. That place, just awesome. Every time I go to Wisconsin, I'm impressed and happy and excited to go back. It happens when I go to Sand Valley or Erin Hills or Blue Mound, any place. It is always awesome. We were there for the girls junior last year at Century World. And, you know, I just love the vibe in Wisconsin almost every time in terms of the golf. The golf is great. It's chill. It's relaxed. And it's beautiful. And I know the seasons are short. But, yeah, I had a great time and my buddies did as well. And that putting course at Erin Hills is next level. That's the best putting course that I've been to yet. It's perfect for Erin Hills. You don't necessarily want to go out after playing 18 holes on that golf course because it's a big golf course and it's a big walk. And when you get done, you just want to grab a drink and go putt. And it's a 12-hole putting course that was excellent. So that's an awesome addition to that place. But that's enough for what I've had going on. Not a lot else. Not a lot of golf happening. It's overseas season in Arizona, so the clubs go away for a few weeks, always kind of a good thing, really. It just reminds you that you actually can miss this sport, you know, if you spend too much time playing it. But yeah, let's get to the guest. Let's get to our guest, Justin Suh, who was nice enough to join us after a couple great weeks on the PGA Tour. And we welcome into the clubhouse, I think for the first time, Justin Suh. We haven't done this before, right?
No, first time. First time being on.
First time, and also I'm happy to finally have a guy on that saw my least graceful walk to an opening tee shot in the history of my golfing career. I never knew we'd ever get to talk about the time I completely ate it walking to the 10th hole at Riviera when we uh, when we played Riv together a few years ago.
Yeah, that was scary. You had a coffee or something in one hand and a bagel in the other with a bag, and you're walking down like the slippery steps going down Riv. Like, oh no, that was a close call.
I remember I was so excited. You and I were, I think you were still at USC, and I was playing Riv because we'd had the amateur coming up there, and I just had never been out there before. I'd never really seen the golf course. And you and I were like 6:30 in the morning, you know, first off, and we're starting on 10, which isn't very intimidating at all. And I just remember I fell, I did the cleats right out from under me on the stairs. I landed on my ass. I complete yard sale everywhere. And all I was thinking was, please nothing be broken. Cause I really wanted to play, you know, wanted to play the golf course. I know you got a chance to play Riv a lot. I'd never got a chance to do it. So luckily nothing was broken and we got a chance to do it, but how are things? How are you?
Everything's good, man. Everything's good. Just trying to navigate through this whole pandemic, just like everyone else. But man, I've been fortunate to get some good spots into some PGA events the past month. I mean, the first one was at Barracuda, where Chris Hoff got me in, and then a couple weeks ago it was Punta Cana with Jay Overton, and now Patrick Lindsay at Shriner. So, you know, I'm just so grateful that these guys gave me a chance to compete and for me to show what I've been doing the past quarantine, just how much I've been working and the game's finally coming up.
Yeah. Can you walk us through something? I know you're new to it as well, but we hear all the time about sponsors invites and spots into events. And as somebody that's learning this process as well, how does it work? You know, for the novice fan that pays attention but doesn't really know the intricacies of how maybe somebody gets into certain events, you know, when they don't have a spot or they're not into it. How does that all work?
You know, relationships have a lot to do with it. Especially, I mean, coming out of college, they definitely take a look at what your ranking is, which helped a lot when me, Matt, Colin, and Victor were getting all these sponsor invites right out of college. So, I mean, I did my due diligence. I sent all my emails, very personal. And, you know, like it's really coming from the heart, because getting a sponsor invite isn't something that that's, you know, like given very often. It's very special to for a tournament director to put their trust in you and see something where they want you to play well and, you know, remember the tournament. So it starts off by just sending the emails. You gotta communicate with them and kind of create a relationship.
Yeah, and I mean, it's worked out well for you. You got a lot of sponsors invited early. You mentioned the press conference. I mean, you mentioned the start with some of those names. You had a press conference at the Travelers alongside Victor and Morikawa and Wolf. But I want to just talk right now about your recent play, which has been great. T14th at the Corrales, you finished T8th, which I believe is your best finish on the PGA Tour at the Shriners last week in Vegas. I know the start to your professional career might not have gone the way you hoped it would, but I feel like the game is where you maybe expected it to be right now. What has kind of clicked for you over the last few weeks?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like you said, the start wasn't something that I wanted. It was a little rough coming straight out of college. It was a stretch of week where I kind of, you know, knew where my wrist was kind of going. I went through that wrist injury right out of college. It was going from like regionals to nationals and flying overnight to Memorial, playing in that rough and flying back over to California. Playing in like a 36-hole qualifier for US Open. So it was dumb on my part. And yeah, just playing a little too much and hitting way too many balls, trying to think I needed to do that to feel comfortable out on the course. So that last season kind of, it taught me a lot and just how to navigate a week of a tournament. And I mean, I learned a lot, but no, what clicked the last few weeks, it's not something that just happened overnight. It's been accumulating for the past half year, where I started I went back to Cali, worked with my coach, Phil Johnson, figuring out this wrist thing where I can swing pretty aggressively at the ball and still not have to deal with this issue. But obviously, like I haven't dealt with the wrist pain in such a long time. It's just something that was there for the first five or four starts on the PGA, which is rough, but coming back from that is, it's not easy. So, I mean, during quarantine and during the whole shutdown, Coach Sambry, you know, I linked back with him and started working on our college drills and working back with Kevin Straduk, our sports psychologist. And you know, it's so satisfying when we put in that much work during technically the off season, just because no one was playing, just to see that hard work pay off in these last few events, it's extremely gratifying.
Yeah, and you touched a little bit on the wrist. Do you mind just kind of expanding on what you've gone through with the injury? Because I know it was something that's just kind of lingering. It seemed like the moment you threw on the professional gear, it was like this wrist thing was just kind of lingering in your life.
Yeah, I mean, I really didn't talk to too many people about it except for the PT guys in the PGA Tour van. I'm working with them literally every tournament. Every day. I remember even at Travelers, like, I couldn't even hit any balls. I just went out on the golf course and think like, well, I should at least get as many reps as I can hitting a golf ball on the golf course, because I don't want to just keep beating balls in a range and make it worse and worse. And the guys came to me, they talked to me in the van, and they said, yeah, you're getting some tendonitis, just from overuse. So, for the next 3 months or so, I was icing it. I was icing it, stretching it, doing some strengthening work on it, just nonstop. And it was tough just because, like, those tournaments, the rough isn't thick. It's not a joke out on the PGA Tour. It's long, it's tough. So being in the rough and, you know, battling it out on the golf course and trying to, like, you know, not get re-injured or make it worse, it was just something where I just couldn't perform like where I wanted to. It was always like, I want to hit this full eight, but I should hit this soft seven instead. So it's just decisions like that that made an impact in those first few starts. But that's just something a lot of athletes go through. But it was just unfortunate. That was right out of college.
Golf is so weird now. I mean, you're a young guy. I mean, you've been pro for less than a couple of years. You were number one ranked amateur in the world. I mean, you had an unbelievable college career at USC. I mean, all these things, and it was just now comes the professional turn. And what's so interesting is, maybe 15, 20 years ago, you had a couple, two or three years to just kind of understand all the inner workings of what being a pro was. I mean, it wasn't just this burst on the scene. You got to go win. You've got to do it right now. How is that in your experience kind of changed? Because, I mean, there are press conferences for you to turn professional. You are seeing your peers win on the PGA Tour. How much pressure is there on a young guy like yourself now to perform right away versus maybe what it was like, you know, in 2000 when guys were turning pro?
I wouldn't really say there's any more pressure, because that's something I like learned how to deal with, especially in college when you get to that number one ranking spot. I got to it my junior year, and you know, it's all these influences that come at you from different angles where other people have these expectations of yourself. So now it's number one, then you're expected to, you know, they think, oh, you're going to win every event. But you just kind of learn how to navigate through that. And I learned through that in college. So when I turned pro, it didn't affect me much or even at all. It was just something I had to go through with that wrist injury. It was just, you know, just bad timing. But yeah, I mean, it's just... now it's the expectation of these young guys, and I'm one of them right now to perform so quickly right out of college. It's exciting. Really is.
It's just so wild how young golf is. I mean, you're living it. You're seeing it. I'm on Latino America. I can only imagine. I mean, Korn Ferry, PGA Tour, it's young everywhere. And the thing I feel like that's really switched is we had young players that were great, and now we have young players that could dominate. You know, that's really the difference is, I mean, we're seeing, I mean, Morikawa, Bryson. I mean, these guys are guys you were competing against, and they've already won major titles. And you see that. Is that motivating? Is it frustrating? Is it motivating? What does it do to you personally when you see the guys you were playing against beating in college, you know, then turning pro, and you see maybe a Morikawa go off and win a couple times, including a major, and Bryson do all the Bryson stuff he's doing? Does it motivate you more? Does it frustrate you more? Does it put more pressure on you?
It's, if anything, it's definitely motivating. See all the guys that I was competing against just a couple of years ago doing what they're doing. It's almost like if they're doing it just so quick, it's almost like a reassurance of you being able to do it as well.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's been kind of like, like I said, the better they do, the better I do. Just because the better they do, I'm like, oh, okay, like, let's step it up. You know, it's, you're always just trying to like work a little harder than the rest of them. So the better they do, you're just kind of like watching. You're like, oh man, like, you just won a major. And it's like, okay, cool. And then the major should be coming pretty soon for me too, if I work hard enough and do the right thing.
Yeah, it's just, again, I'm so impressed by the youthful mentality now. You know, I mean, I think you probably could link it back to Spieth. I mean, I'm sure you could go back to Tiger, but Tiger, I feel like comparing stuff to Tiger is just a fool's errand at this point. But, you know, you go back to Spieth, and he's a teenager, and he wins on tour. And then it seemed almost like it was expected. And I remember, I mean, I'm sure you heard it 1,000 times. I heard it 1,000 times as well about Justin Thomas. At one point, he was this friend of Spieth's, right? That was what always got attached to Justin Thomas is, oh, he's Spieth's buddy. Oh, he's Spieth's friend. Because JT didn't win a lot early in his career, and it maybe took JT a couple more years to understand how the professional golf thing worked. And, you know, he'd get close and just wouldn't close it out. And I just am, I'm shocked at how confident the young players are as they turn professional and how they expect success right away. It's not, I want to win. It's, I expect to win. And I feel like that is a big change on the PGA Tour for sure.
Yeah, I think if anything, I think Brooks, he's even said it. It's almost just like a mindset where, like, if you know and really believe that you're going to have a chance to win at these events, it's going to be likely. Just if you really believe in it. And for me to see all these young guys and Stuart Jordan and Justin just, you know, dominate so quick, it's for us, like, it's just like, oh, like, it's going to happen. It could happen. It's just a matter of how you work. I mean, everyone gets there in different ways. It's just finding your own path and learning what works best for you.
So if you could just kind of walk us through, you know, you going from college to pro and what's happened for you and where you've gone, where you've played, the good, the bad and everything just over the last couple of years, just to give people an idea of what happens as you're bouncing around, you know, professional golf and some of the different tours.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a wild ride. I've been kind of everywhere since I graduated.
A lot of miles? You're racking up the miles in,
yeah,
the rental cars?
A lot of miles, a lot of rental cars, a lot of hotel rooms. But yeah, so I mean, right out of college, I got the 7 stars from, it was Memorial Travelers, Detroit, 3M, John Deere, and Barracuda. I believe that's 7. If I'm missing one, I apologize. It was just a lot of traveling during that summer. But I mean, those all 7 of those events, I mean, coming with that wrist injury, it was all close calls. And just even making the cut, I think I missed almost every single one of them under 2 shots or 2 or 3 shots, maybe even 1 a few times. So it was just so close every week, kind of even playing almost behind the field, every event. So like mentally I was like, it's going to happen. Like there was never a doubt in my mind where, oh, like my game isn't good enough. It's just a matter of being healthy and confident going into the golf course. So after those 7 starts, you know, there's nothing else really going on besides the playoffs. So me and my agent, we talked and there was a sponsor invite down at, Latin America. So I got a sponsor invite there and I think I had probably a month off to like get healthy and everything was feeling good. But that was in the very beginning transition of working with Bill and getting my swing just a little different and more comfortable for like a long run term. So I went down to Peru for the first event. I think I was leading after the 3rd round, finished T4, next event finished 2nd. In Argentina, next event finished 10th, and next event finished, I think, 8th, the final event. So it was 4 straight top 10s down in Latin America. Then we have a couple more months off, and then I played in 3 PGA events from January to February. It was the Farmers, the AT&T, and Puerto Rico. And that's where everything, like, even though I missed the cut there too, unfortunately, so it was a lot of miscuts, but it was a lot of learning. That's where it kind of clicked for me at AT&T, especially where I think I was T14 going to the 3rd round and it's a third round cut. And I was making that turn at Spyglass, and the wind was just, you know, 30 miles an hour. That was the last group. Greens were getting bumpy. So it was just a tough stretch. But that's where it really clicked for me, where I was like, okay, like I'm seeing some results. And almost fortunately for me, COVID hit just like in relation to
your
me
game.
Being able to work a little more and, you know, like super sad times. But like for me, like it was a time to really just, you know, get back, diagnose what's really needed, get back to work on the range, get back to doing our drills with Coach Zambri. I put in a lot of hours. I fortunately had like Joe Bramlett, who's like a big brother to me. We both moved out to Vegas in January, or he's been out there for a couple of years, but I moved out there and we just went to work. I mean, we were out there every morning, every afternoon, just practicing, getting better, getting our numbers down. And I was fortunate to have a playing companion out on the golf course. And yeah, got these starts just the past couple months and just seeing some results now.
I love listening to stuff like that because, you know, I'm not sure that even I am as aware of this as I should be. Is, you know, we see the PGA Tour players and even Korn Ferry and LPGA and European Tour, and there's a schedule and it's set. And if you're in that world, then your schedule is set for you. And you've got an event basically every single week, especially, you know, on the PGA Tour. Max Holm on the other podcast I do, Get a Grip, we were talking a little bit about when he turned professional last week on the episode, and we were talking about his desire to finish top 10 because that meant he could play another week. And without that, you might go 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and not know when you're going to play again. And as I'm listening to you talk, I feel like you fell a little into that as well, where, you know, you have a good week, you play well, you finish fourth, you finish eighth, you four top tens, and then you have to take 3 or 4 weeks off from playing in events. That has to be one of the bigger adjustments from college golf to professional. Is at least in college golf, if things are going well, you know events are coming up. And if they're not going well, you know you've got events coming up where you can change the tide, if you will. Professional's not like that if it's not a set schedule, right? It's you're going to have these weeks off, and you basically have got to wait for another opportunity.
Yeah, especially where I was in particular, it's just you kind of always have to be ready because these opportunities can come out of nowhere. So, I mean, I get the call from Peter probably or like a week or tournament director a week before the tournament. So it's like, boom, you got to book your flight. You got to just get in that mindset of playing in a tournament in a few days. But yeah, that's just kind of what you have to go through the first couple of years when you turn pro, I think, and it's just wild. I mean, it's everything's kind of you're almost winging the schedule as you go because based on your performance that dictates if you're, like you said, in the next event or you got to wait in a few weeks, maybe a month, for another chance.
Yeah, I was reading a Golf Digest article Brian Wacker did on you in September. He mentioned how close you've been in Monday qualifying. He said, "I think you shot something like 30 under over the course of a few Monday Qs. How close were you? How many events was that in a row? And how great were you playing and getting so close?"
So after I think it was right after March, once everything was closed and after I got to work, and then we're like, okay, the season's coming back up. Monday qualifiers are opening back up. Let's see where we're at. Let's try to get something going. So I signed up for this Monday qualifier in Utah and I shot 7 under there, went in like this 8-hole playoff until it was pitch black at night. I actually had a chance to, two putt to make it, but it was so dark and it was such a long day. I just kind of, you know, couldn't really see the break and I kind of guessed and then I just made a mess out of it. But I shot 7 under there, missing a playoff following week. Gosh, I can't remember. Can't really remember all the places, but I went like 7 under, like 7 under again in Briggs Ranch, missed it by one, then came back again at Briggs Ranch in San Antonio, shot 8 under, missed it by one. And it was ridiculous. I mean, I played in like 4, 5, or 6, almost 6. And then went to Chicago and a couple other places, all missed by like 1 or 2 shots. And it was just so draining. You're just like, God, like these Mondays are brutal. Like, you got guys, I mean, playing for 4 spots in 156 guy field I mean, there's going to be some guys who just get hot with the putter. And for me, it wasn't like I was getting hot, but I was playing such good golf. So what's it called? I was playing such good golf every week where it was just one shot, like one putt. And it was just draining. You're like, God dang.
It's such a glimpse into a world that I mean, and you know, there's that great Monday Q Twitter account now that really highlights, you know, what is all about a Monday qualifier. But this is, again, we talk so much and see so much about the biggest events and the guys that play great there and the guys that win. And you forget that there's dudes that are shooting 7 and 8 under in a Monday qualifier and not getting in. And you were doing it week after week after week. So it's like, I'm sure there was a level to you of being really frustrated that you weren't getting into the events. And at the same time, I'm sure if you're talking to a coach or a friend, they're going, dude, you are playing awesome. Like you said, you're 30 under par over the span of 4 or 5 Monday Qs. And you're like, I'm leading the Monday qualifier scoring average. That just doesn't that didn't pay me any money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is, I think I also am one of those guys who believes everything happens for a reason.
Right.
And after missing all those Mondays, the tournament directors are watching those. And fortunately for me, Chris Hoff, he gave me that first chance to come back out. He's like, dude, I've been watching your Monday cues. If there's anyone who needs a break, it's you. So he gave me that chance to come out to Barracuda. And I was so pumped. I mean, I remember being in Vegas and getting that call. I was like, let's go. Like, we're ready. Going straight up to Truckee. I drove up there with my own car, stayed with a buddy of mine who actually lives right next to that golf course. And it was just one great week to not just make the cut, but be in contention with Joseph Bramlett, who I worked so hard with at my home course. It was special. It was just something just clicked where I was like, okay, this is it. And just, you know, carrying that momentum all the way to Punta Cana, getting the chance over there and performing at the Shriners. It's been really, really great.
Yeah, I had Sophia Popoff on the podcast last month, and she said something similar to the way you've been talking. She said that, you know, somebody that had struggled and was looking for a break and was looking for something to click in the golf game. And it was really the pandemic for her as well that allowed her to spend time on parts of her game that she needed to work on. And it seems like that was very similar to you. I mean, you've mentioned Coach Zambri, who's the head golf coach at USC, where you went. I was texting with him yesterday, and he said you were talking a lot about short game. You were trying to sharpen up the short game because you've noticed how great the short games are professionally on the PGA Tour for the best in the world. And he also said that it felt like you just needed and wanted someone to just talk with on results, on what was working and what wasn't. How nice has it been to have that soundboard that you had for so long, you know, in California, to now have again, to just help you look at things and go, this is working, this is great, things are awesome, and we need to sharpen this up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it helps a lot because Coach Zambri, especially in my college career, he's got, I mean, all my data. Like, he's probably recorded every single shot I've hit within those 4 years. I practice and on the golf course. So he knows my game just as much as anyone else. So he knows, I mean, he broke it down with me with the data. He's like, dude, get your short game better. Get to work on that. I was like, okay. And he's not a guy who really tells me exactly the fundamentals of what's going on. He's like, he just tells me get better at this.
Right.
And then he gives me the chance to figure it out on my own, which I've always worked really well with, and just, you know, seeking my own help, or, you know, being out on the golf course and putting in the hours and figuring it out on my own. I'm so, so thankful for Coach Zambri just to be that sounding board of, you know, like, just tell me, get better at this. You're doing pretty good at this. Spend some more time on this. it's really just as simple as that. I remember calling him after Punta Cana, like literally 2 days later after our tournament. I'm like, hey coach, like, what'd you see out there? He's like, well, you know, this looked pretty good and this didn't. So, get to work. I'm like, all right, cool. And then we just got back to doing our drills. I got on the range, did the drills, sent him our scores. Got the call into Shriners a couple of days later, and he was pumped. And so was I.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back. So So of those guys you came up with, you know, the names we've already mentioned, you know, Hovland and Morikawa, Wolf. I mean, you could even throw in guys like, I mean, I'm assuming, you know, Bryce and Rahm, those types of guys were in and around the college game when you were there. Who are you closest with of that crew? And are you a guy that will reach out to even appear and go, hey, man, I've got a couple questions on things that, you know, maybe are that have worked or things that I want to work on or just ideas in and around the professional golf space? Is that something you do? And which person would you actually talk to about that?
Yeah, I was actually, Colin is who I'm probably closest with out of those names that you mentioned. And I remember before Punta Cana, I think one of the articles, it kind of took it out of context, but we just played in this like 18 hole match, like in the morning, just, you know, first one off. It was right after he won pretty soon after he won the PGA. And I was like, all right, like, let's see where my game is compared to his right now. And you know, we were just playing quick, but still a match is a match. And we were both pretty into it. And I ended up getting him by 2 up. I mean, he got his revenge on me before Shriners, and I think he beat me by like 4 up. So it's just kind of a friendly match. But I mean, a guy where I'm just like, okay, I was playing with him a year ago. He just won a major. And, you know, just getting that little win off an 18 hole match was like, all right, cool. Like, the game's there. Like, it was just kind of that little period, like, okay, game's there. Not, like, it's just still golf. And we definitely, I mean, I asked him a few questions about, you know, like what it was like winning the major, like what'd you learn? Like, what's the single most thing you took away from it? You know, we're just trading info, and it's really nice to have these young guys that I played with helping me, because they've been so successful.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, the wins that are boosts to who you are and what you do. You know, I mean, it's a silly match for, you know, $20 or whatever, and you're playing, but you want to win, and you really want to win. I've got a couple of buddies here that play mini tour golf in Phoenix, and we've played with a couple of my friends that play professionally. And, you know, we're playing in a money game, or we're playing in a Nassau, or whatever we're doing personally. And I can see in those guys that are playing, that are my friends that are playing mini tour and hoping to one day ascend to, you know, Korn Ferry or PGA Tour or whatever, I can see how hard they're battling, because it's not just a round of golf for those guys, right? It's a chance to level up and see where you're at. And if you can compete, if there are things they do that you don't. And so it's very interesting, some of the motivation that comes from things that nobody knows about, you know, like you said, a friendly 6 a.m. match, you know, where you're first off and you're just going out there and battling. What has for you been the biggest surprise about pro golf versus amateur and collegiate golf? And I mean, this also coming from a guy that I believe you played at the Oakmont U.S. Open. So, I mean, you've obviously seen pro golf up close as you were playing collegially. But now that you're really in the mix, what's been the most surprising part?
Well, just going back to the first, the question before, I just want to say, between, I know all those names mentioned, like, I do have to, thank Joseph Bramlin. I mean, he's literally been my big brother through all this. So there's all those guys out there, but Joe's got a lot of experience on the PGA, and I got to thank him so much, because he's my big brother. He helps me out. I'm playing with him every practice round, every tournament we're out there. So first of all, I really want to thank him for kind of taking me under his wing. But yeah, like off the PGA Tour, like what I've learned, and I mean, I think the most I've learned is the pace. The pace of the PGA is very different than college golf. In college golf, you're playing in a threesome. You've got coaches kind of hovering around every tee box, and you got probably 6 hours of playing time out there.
Right.
Where, you know, it's slow. You're waiting every tee. Then you have time to really, you know, take a step back and just kind of relax on the golf course. But on the PGA, totally different. And that's something I definitely had to change after those first few starts where, you know, slow play is a really bad rep out there.
you don't want to be a slow player as a pro, is what you're saying.
No, it's not a great rep to have. And the pace of like being just a little behind, I mean, I think a lot of people on Instagram, they see these fines that they implicate on having a slow bad penalty, and they don't realize like there's a lot of guys out there who don't have the funds, like the top five guys in the world, where a 10 grand penalty is costly.
It's a huge hit. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. So I remember I got one warning at Barracuda after our first round. It was just kind of a miscommunication between the guy I was playing with and whose turn it was. But I got this one bad time, and the official came up to me, and he's like, "Okay, I'm giving you a bad time." I'm like, "Okay, I understand." And he said, "The next one is like something fine." It was a pretty big number, and I was like, "Jeez, like." All right.
So, I'll speed up.
Right after that, I was like, oh my God, let me change my routine just a little bit. But you just have to, you just have to be at a point where you're reacting instead of just thinking on the golf course. You're reacting to shots. You got the number down because you've done it so many times while practicing and in competitive rounds. You're just reacting to the golf course. And now I'm at a state where when I step on the golf course, it's so fun, so much more exciting, because you get into this really cool flow of being out on the golf course and just playing golf and hitting the shots that you and your caddy discuss right off the bat. So that's something I learned a lot coming out of college.
Yeah, is this something that now you hope or wish college would press players on, is to be a little bit quicker or to speed up? Because if the transition goes from you have all the time in the world to now all of a sudden you've kind of got to go, go, go. I mean, that can be a big change for a player. You know, if they're used to having all the time they need on a tee or a green or whatever, do you hope or wish college would push players to speed up a bit or even penalize them more?
Yeah. I mean, it's just really tough because the way it's structured and the way, it's just different in college because you're playing more as a team rather than an individual. So coaches want to have that input and help players out on par threes and certain difficult shots. So it's really different. And even if you try to get that pace of play up, it won't really compare to what it's like on tour, where on Saturday, Sunday, you're playing with just a twosome and you can't fall behind. Cause if you do, a guy's going to come right over you and he's going to be like, pick it up, and you have to, or else you're going to get a fine or you're going to get timed.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, hopefully in the next couple of years, there's something where college kids or like students can really understand that it's a different change right off the bat.
Yeah. I mean, I think a friend of mine always preaches that, playing quickly is a skill. I mean, it's not, playing quickly well is a skill, right? I mean, playing as fast as Rory and Dustin Johnson play and able to play at the level they play at is pretty impressive because, a lot of golfers need a little bit more time. So it is a change and something you've got to completely flip in terms of how you're approaching the game as well. If all of a sudden you feel like you're in a hurry all the time, being in a hurry is never good in golf. I mean, you never want to be in a hurry to rush to the golf course because you're late for a tee time or, you're trying to get up there and hit your golf shot and you feel like you're on the clock. So it is a little bit of a, maybe more of a skill than maybe people think it is.
Yeah, and it's also the transition from being able to use a Bushnell when you play.
Exactly.
When you use a Bushnell, like, you're playing quick. Like, you can just get it, boom, you're ready. But now transitioning that from college to actually using a yardage book, actually looking at your pin sheet and doing the math, doing the numbers, then figuring out where the sprinkler head is and trying to get the best number you can in relation to the pin, like, that's all time. And to be able to do that more efficiently and a lot quicker with your caddy, that takes practice. That takes a lot of trust in your caddy to get his number and match it up with yours. So, that's something that I've definitely learned too. And I've been fortunate to find a caddy, AJ Montesino, who works so well with me.
And I was reading that you, when the injury was going on and you were missing cuts, you'd kind of spend time on the phone and specifically on social media. And as a guy myself who is trying really hard right now to distance himself from social media, how is that experience and how much have you kind of kept it at arm's length to just simply keep your sanity? Because it's not good for anybody to be scrolling, right? It's not good for anybody to be scrolling through stuff when you're, not the happiest you can be.
Exactly. And I think especially since I was injured, I wasn't able to work out as I wanted to. I couldn't, be as active. So after a tournament, or a tournament round or a practice round, I'm literally just in my hotel room, just watching Netflix or going through my phone for hours and hours and hours. And it was just not something that was healthy for me or my game. And then you're looking at, you know, so many swings where it's just like, people don't realize, like, if you look at that many swings, it'll do something, you know, especially when like, especially when your game is not where you want it to be, where mine wasn't at the time. It was just, you know, it just kind of affected it little by little. So I just had to distance myself away from it and just kind of have a healthier relationship where, I can still be, you know, interactive with people who follow me and support me, on Instagram and other certain apps, but still have time to, you know, give it. I just have to be disciplined. Like, yeah, when I practice, when I, you know, when I, when I'm home with some friends, like, I try to stay away. I don't use it. I try to focus on what's, you know, being right in front of me and just staying present, instead of being distracted in a whole different world on social media.
So last thing I wanted to do was, I heard, I mean, Justin, I know you, you're a smart kid. You went to USC, you know, you're a guy, you're a bright guy, but I've heard that there's one flaw in your brain, and that comes with US geography. And I've heard you struggle mightily by naming the state to the city. So if I give you a city, I've heard you're not the best at knowing what state it's in. Is this fair to say?
This is going to make me look so bad,
no,
Jay.
No, I have a couple of layups. I have one tough one. And then I'm not grilling you. I'm not giving you like Concord, New Hampshire or something. Okay. So
no,
you're
Jay,
good to go.
Look, trust me, any of them is a tough one.
So you listen, now I know, you know, California, by the way, I love that Coach Zambry told me this, because it's just,
So
you've got California down. I'm assuming, you know, Sacramento and all LA and San Diego and all those things. Can you give me Chicago?
Illinois. I was just there.
Illinois. Nice. See, I knew you could knock it out. I've got a kind of a off the beaten path city that I feel like you're going to get. I've got confidence in you, Justin.
Oh my gosh. I'm nervous.
Corpus Christi.
Say that one more time.
Corpus Christi.
Shane, this is deja vu, okay? I had my senior year, the whole team sitting on the lounge, the whole girls and guys team and the coaches do this to me for an hour, and it was humiliating.
What would you say your percentage was when they were doing this to you and you were a senior?
I almost don't want to say, because it's pretty bad.
Yeah, I did this thing. We were doing the Get a Grip thing, Max, like during pandemic one time. He just threw this at me. He goes, I want to quiz you on golf trivia during the podcast. And all of a sudden I get super nervous, because I feel confident in my ability to know stuff about golf, but the last thing I do is want to come off as some idiot that doesn't know, you know, what Tiger's cut streak was, or, you know, who won the 1935 Masters. I mean, I want to feel like I know all these things, and I got super nervous. So I totally understand where you're coming from. This is, by the way, my new favorite thing. I want this to be on your Wikipedia page one day. Somebody's going to have to edit it and just say not great at Des Moines. Doesn't know where Des Moines is, but unbelievable at a lot of other things.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know where the city or state was, where you just said, before I just said that, but I was trying to avoid that question.
I got you. You're all good. what's your schedule like the rest of the year into next year? What do you have planned? Like what's definitely on the schedule, and what are you hoping you can add on the schedule?
So the next 2 weeks we have off for CJ and Zozo. I'm definitely in the Bermuda Championship because of this top 10 at Shriners.
Nice.
And we're hopeful for Houston and Mexico. But you know, good golf at Bermuda would definitely help. But right now what's definite is Bermuda, and that's where my focus is right now.
Yeah. And I mean, you get a chance to, unfortunately you live in Vegas and I live in Scottsdale, and right now every golf course is getting overseeded and there's nowhere to play, but I'm assuming there's somewhere to practice. But this is always the biggest bummer about living in the desert, is when the nice weather finally comes. I mean, it's been brutal in Arizona the whole summer. The weather finally breaks and we have all the golf courses get scalped. And you're like, no. This is when we want to play golf. This is when we want to go out on the golf course.
Exactly.
So hopefully you have a place that you can at least go bang some balls and practice for a little bit.
Yeah, I do. And you know, this was my first summer out in the desert, and coming from Cali and having to deal with 110 and 115 on such a regular basis, it was a huge adjustment.
Yeah, it was. I've noticed any of the guys that moved to Arizona, you know, the professional golfers ended up in Arizona, especially this year with the pandemic. You know, everybody was kind of home the whole time. Like, man, it's 115 a lot. I'm like, yeah, pretty much the whole summer it's 115. You got to get your work in early or late. But Justin,
exactly.
I appreciate the time. I appreciate you jumping on. I was pumped to see, you know, the couple of weeks in a row of great play. I know you've been obviously working a lot on it. And for you, I can only imagine seeing the finishes. You know, you get so close in Mondays, you get so close in other events to finally see it come into play at the big events, at the PGA Tour events, has to make you feel super satisfied by what you've gone through the last year and a half.
It does. It really does. I mean, everyone in my team, they've been working so hard and just getting me set up to where I'm at now, and to see everything click and to see myself compete and have so much fun on the golf course and being up there in the leaderboard. It's definitely satisfying.
Well, Justin, I appreciate it. Good luck the rest of the year and into next year. I'm sure I'll see you down the road at some point. And yeah, I mean, keep at it. And Des Moines is in Iowa. There you go. That's your.
Thanks, Shane. I'll remember that one.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back. A big thanks to Justin. Big thanks to you for listening. If you like the show and you haven't rated or reviewed it, do that. That's a nice thing to do, and it helps us out, and it helps the podcast. Big thanks to iHeart. And just wanted to let you know, if you like this podcast, if you haven't listened to Get a Grip with Max Homa and Shane Bacon, it's the other podcast I do with Max Homa, who's on the PGA Tour. Make sure you subscribe and listen to that as well, because we have fun with that. It's weekly. It is kind of all over the place, depending on what happened that week. And yeah, make sure you check that out as well. We'll be back soon with another guest. The Clubhouse with Shane Bacon is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.